From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, the thrill isn't gone. The eminent blues guitarist B.B. King turned 80 years old last week, and he's still performing about 100 shows a year. He's won 13 Grammys and sold millions of records. We'll listen back to an interview with King and hear about his life and music, from sharecropping and getting his first guitar to becoming a blues legend. Also, David Edelstein reviews David Cronenberg's new film, The History of Violence, starring Viggo Mortensen and Ed Harris. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews the new HBO comedy Extras, starring Ricky Gervais, who co-created and starred in the original British version of The Office. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Blues legend B.B. King turned 80 this month, and he's not just alive, he's kicking. He still performs 100 shows a year. He owns a string of blues clubs and just released an album of duets with other artists called 80. He has a new book called B.B. King's Treasures. It's full of photos from his career and facsimiles of mementos from his life, such as flyers advertising his early gigs and sharecropping records from his childhood. B.B. King has won 13 Grammys. He's traveled the world, met four presidents and a pope, and was named a living legend by the Library of Congress. But he said recently it was a bigger thrill when the state senate of his native Mississippi honored him by proclaiming B.B. King Day. When he was growing up, he said he was afraid to go there. Terry Gross spoke to B.B. King in 1996 after he'd released his autobiography called Blues All Around Me. We'll hear their conversation in a moment. Here's a little more of B.B. King's 1972 recording, Five Long Years.
If you ever have been mistreated, then you know just what I'm talking about. If you ever been mistreated, people, oh, you know just what I'm talking about. I tell you, I work five long years for a woman. And she has the nerve to put me out. You know I got a job at a steel mill, trucking steel like a slave. Five long years every Friday, I went straight home. Well, all of my pain, you ever been mistreated, people, then you know just what I'm talking about. I tell you, I work five long years for a woman. And she has the nerve to put me out.
B.B. King, what was your very first guitar like?
My very first guitar was a little red guitar about 2.5 feet long. It had a hole in the center, and it was made by a company called Stella, and it was red.
Did you think that was cool or silly?
No, I thought this was the greatest thing that ever happened to me. Uh-huh. A guitar made a sound, you plucked the strings. Man, how much more heaven can you have? That's the way it seemed to me at the time. Believe it or not, I still hear the sound of that sound, if you will, through the guitar that I play today.
You hear the sound of that very first red guitar?
Yes, I do. Mm-hmm.
Now, I love the way you describe developing your style. It sounds like you developed your style by trying and failing to imitate your influences. People like Lonnie Johnson, Blind Lemon Jefferson, your cousin Buckle White, Django Reinhardt, Charlie Christian,
yes. I'm still doing that.
You're still trying and failing?
Yeah, trying and failing, yes.
Now, you also loved Hawaiian guitar. How did you hear Hawaiian guitar, and why was it so exciting to you? It was another sound you tried to emulate.
Well, I'd hear it on the radio. I would hear the Hawaiian sound, or the country music players play steel and slide guitars, if you will. And I hear that. To me, a steel guitar is one of the sweetest sounds this side of heaven. I still like it, and that was one of the things that I tried to do so much was to imitate that sound. I could never get it. I still haven't been able to do it. And that was the beginning of the trill on my hand.
Tell me more about the trill on your hand.
Well, it's, how can I tell you? It's sort of like, it's not really pushing and pulling the strings like a lot of guitar players think I do. But it's like kind of just shaking your hand and getting a vibration on the string a little bit. So maybe a mini bit of pushing and pulling, but not from the strength of my hand. It's just from the shaking of it.
Now, also, you play a kind of single line guitar as opposed to, you know, chords or rhythm guitar. Tell me also about developing that style of single note.
Well, every time I've worked in a band, I was always featured. And they'd hardly let me play in the rhythm section. Usually, for some reason, most of the players would always say, B, take the solo, take the lead. And I got in the habit of doing that. So I put more emphasis on the single string than I did the chords. I can play a few chords, but I'm no great chord player. But, for example, if you were singing or playing, I could play chords pretty well behind you with a guideline. The guideline means if I had a bass player or keyboard player, somebody that's playing the chords, I could play then. I could play behind you very well. But other than that, I'm sad. Anybody hear me play by myself, I've just lost that person. You know, they won't listen to me anymore. That's the end.
So did you feel that your strength lay not in just being a guitar player or in just being a singer, but in doing both together?
I think both together. I started to feel that I, you know, had to be a good entertainer to keep a job. And I'm kind of happy that I developed in my head that I'm never any better than my last concert or my last time I played. So it's like an audition each time. Quite often, it's quite a bit like some say when you're going on stage, you have stage fright. In so many words, you get nervous just before going on stage. And I still have that, but I think it's more like concern. You're concerned about the people. It's like meeting your in-laws for the first time.
When I first got the blues, they brought me over on a ship. Men were standing over me, and a lot more with the whip. And everybody want to know why I sing the blues. Well, I've been around a long time. I've really paid my dues. I've laid in the ghetto flats, cold and numb. I heard the rats tell the bedbugs to give the roaches some. Everybody wanna know why I'm singing the blues. Yes, I've been around a long time. People, I've paid my dues. I stood in line down at the county hall. I heard a man say, we're gonna build some new apartments for y'all. And everybody wanna know. Yes, they wanna know why I'm singing the blues. Yes, I've been around a long, long time. Yes, I've really, really paid my dues. Now I'll play Lucille.
You're from a family of sharecroppers. What was the work that you had to do?
Well, I was a regular hand when I was about seven. I chopped cotton. I picked cotton. I helped to plant it. I did everything that the grown-ups do, and that's mostly the work what had to do with. Cotton was the king, if you will, of the produce in the Mississippi Delta when I was growing up. peanuts maybe later and soybeans later, but cotton still is today one of the main producers that's raised in the Mississippi Delta.
Now, what was the financial arrangement between your family and the plantation owner?
Well, a sharecropper was meant to be exactly what they say, sharecropper. But generally, the boss that owned the plantation did all of the paperwork, if you will. He was the CPA. he did all of that, and he sold the produce that you raised. For example, Jim, you earned, after paying me back the advances I gave you, you made 25 bales of cotton, and the cotton brought maybe $5,000 a bale, and you owed me, say, 25 times that, except maybe $2,000. So here's your $1,800.
You know what I'm wondering? When you were growing up on a plantation, family of sharecroppers, did you vow to yourself early on, I'm getting out of here?
Well, not really. Believe it or not, people lived on the plantation, felt like that this was really home, most of them. And we're being taken care of because the boss of the plantation usually was like your lawyer, your judge, your father, your mom. He was your practically everything. And people lived on the plantation, sort of felt, believe it or not, secure to be there. If they needed a few bucks, usually they could get this from the boss man, and it's taken out at the end of the year. At that time, we didn't have telephones. We didn't have electricity or anything of that sort. Later on, I guess we had electricity maybe a year or so before I left when I was 18 years old. And this was all taken care of through a system that you would pay at the end of the year, which came out of your earnings. So a lot of the people, including myself, the early years, just thought that this was it, you know. This, you raise your families, and you get old, die, your families take over, kids and what have you, and it's an ongoing process, if you will. But I somehow later start to feel that there was more for me and a few others. I think it's the same way with young people today. They feel that they're not really happy with the status quo,
right,
if that makes sense.
Right.
B.B. King speaking with Terry Gross in 1996. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're listening to Terry's 1996 interview with B.B. King, who turned 80 this month. Before we get back to their conversation, let's listen to Miss Martha King, recorded in 1949. It was B.B. King's first record.
You grew up on a plantation, then left it to go to Memphis, which is where you started really playing music professionally. It's a great story how you left the plantation. You were driving a tractor. This was a problematic tractor that had it had problems with after ignition. So one day you turned off the tractor, walked out of the tractor, and then the tractor started jumping on its own, rammed into the barn. The exhaust pipe got crushed or, you know, broke off.
Broke off, yes.
And you were afraid of how much money you'd owe the plantation owner.
No, I was afraid that I would be killed.
Oh, even worse.
No. Well, he'd never kill anybody, but he, I don't mean it that way, but scared to death. You know, like if you, your mom cooked a cake and you decided that, you know, you're going to get a piece of it and you drop it, you know, and it spills on the floor. Brand new cake that's made for the family, you would feel that mom is going to surely kill you, so you better get out of there. Well, that's the way I felt that the time that the tractor, when it backfired, you know, and ran out of there. It scared me half to death. So I panicked and left, hitchhiked to Memphis. Going from Indianola to Memphis then was like, to me, like leaving Chicago, going to Philly. It was that far. That's the way it seemed at the time. So I was scared to death. I left and stayed for a while and communicated back with my family and my cousin, Booker White, said, go on back there and take your medicine. So I finally went back, and Mr. Barrett was a very nice guy, a man that I admired so much. I wished I could be a lot more like him.
Bluesman Sonny Boy Williamson had a radio show when you got to Memphis, King Biscuit time, and you went up to him and asked to sing on the program. It seems to me like you must have had the courage to just come in like that.
Well, before I left Indianola, my hometown, Indianola, Mississippi, I used to hear Sonny Boy over in Helena, Arkansas.
Mm-hmm.
He would come on air each day at 12:15 and for about 15 minutes for the King Biscuit Company. And I felt that I knew him. It's sort of like watching TV or listening to you. A person listen to you and feel that they can trust you and feel that they really know you. You become like a name in the family. So that's the way I felt when I met him. I didn't know him, but it seemed to me I had known him all this time. So when I got to Memphis, he was in West Memphis, which is across the Mississippi River in Arkansas. I went over and I guess I would have been hurt very badly had he not talked with me.
He let you sing on his show?
Yes, he did. I guess he said a guy got this much nerve, and I'm very homely looking.
What'd you sing?
I sang one of Ira Joe Hunter's songs. Ira Joe Hunter, if you're not familiar with him, was a great songwriter and great musician. He made a lot of tunes, one or two that you probably have heard. Anyway, I sang one of his tunes called Blues at Sunrise.
And you got a response?
Very much so. Sonny Boy seemed to like it. And Sonny Boy was a very big guy, you know, and his eyes was not very clear, looked a little red-like, and he was a very big fella, and at that time I weighed about 127, and he stood about 6 feet or more, and looking down on me, you know, like, hey, you better sing right. And I said, yes, sir.
Well, you ended up getting your own radio show as well as your own gigs in Memphis. When you were on the radio, one of the things that we had to do was sing, well, write and then sing a jingle for Pepticon, which was what, a kind of cure-all remedy?
Yes. Pepticon was a tonic that was supposed to be good for whatever ails you. And we sold a lot of it. And I think a lot of it had to do, I didn't learn until much later that it was 12% alcohol. So a lot of the older people bought it, especially church people. They bought a lot of it.
The only way to drink and be legit.
Well, I won't say that, but I do know that they bought it, and older people mostly bought it, and someone sent me a bottle about 6 or 7 years ago. I have it at home now, and it was, I think, 12% alcohol.
Would you sing the jingle you wrote?
Well, do you really want me to do this?
Mm-hmm.
You really do. Okay. Pepticon show is good. Pepticon show is good. Pepticon show is good. You can get it anywhere in your neighborhood.
And did that sell a lot of Pepticon?
We sold a lot of it. I used to ride the trucks on the weekend with the salesman, and people would stand in line, sort of like going to a concert or a movie. We sold a lot of it.
B.B. King speaking with Terry Gross in 1996. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
You act like you don't want to listen when I'm talking to you. You think you ought to do, baby, anything you want to do. You must be crazy, baby. You just gotta be out of your mind. As long as I'm paying the bill, woman, I'm paying the cost to be the boss. I'll drink if I wanna and play a little poker too. Don't you say nothing to me, as long as I'm taking care of you. As long as I'm working, baby, and paying all the bills, I don't want no mouth from you about the way I'm supposed to live. You must be crazy, woman. Just gotta be out of your mind. As long as I'm footing the bill and paying the cost to be the boss. Got me, you act like you ashamed. You don't act like my woman. You just use
major funding for Fresh Air comes from this and other NPR member stations and from Barnes & Noble, publishers of portable professor audio courses, including The Great Good Book, The Bible and the Roots of Western Literature. Additional support for NPR comes from Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Absent Friends, a novel of friendship, homicide, and secrets by S.J. Rosen, available in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more with blues legend B.B. King. He recently turned 80 years old. Also, David Edelstein reviews the new Cronenberg film, The History of Violence. And David Bianculli looks at the new HBO comedy Extras, starring Ricky Gervais, about an actor who gets only non-speaking parts as an extra. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, in for Terry Gross. Blues legend B.B. King turned 80 this month, but he hasn't slowed down much. He's still recording and performing 100 shows a year. He has a new book called B.B. King Treasures, which features photos and mementos from his life and career. We're listening back to Terry's 1996 interview with King, recorded when he'd released his autobiography, Blues All Around Me.
Now I want to get to another record recorded in 1952. You were 26. This is a recording of 3 o'clock Blues. It had been a hit a few years before for Lowell Folsom.
Right.
This was your first number one record on the R&B charts.
Very first.
You're coming into your own here, don't you think, as a stylist?
I'm a very happy guy to know that somebody tells me that I have a hit record. I was very happy to hear that. I think that's music to each performer's ear to hear that they have a top-selling record or CD.
Let's hear it.
Now it is 3 o'clock in the morning. Can't even close my eyes. Well, I can't find my baby. No, and I can't be satisfied.
That's B.B. King, recorded in 1952. How did that record, your first record, went to number one on the R&B charts, change your life?
Well, it changed my life in many ways. One thing, financially, because I had been making about $60 a week at this radio station. And I would go out and pick cotton. I would drive trucks and tractors. I did everything to try to make ends meet, if you will, because my music wasn't taking care of me. And when I made 3 o'clock Blues, I started then to get guarantees, maybe like $400 or $500 a day when I played out. And that made a big difference, as far as financially speaking, because then I could hire more people to work with me, made life easier. I could get a driver to keep from having to drive all the different places by myself. And my wife and I was able to live better, able to pay the band better. I was able to do many things that I hadn't been able to do prior to that. And, of course, popularity was much more popular, if you will. And I just started to feel then that I was a real entertainer.
In the 1950s, you toured on a black music circuit, and you weren't crossing over, even into the early 60s, to white audiences, the way other African-American performers who were playing more rock and roll had started to do. Chuck Berry, Little Richard. Did you want to cross over? Were you frustrated that you weren't crossing over?
Well, in the beginning, I was really confused about the way the politics ran in music. I always thought if you made a good record, it was a good record. If it was a hit record, it was a hit record. And people, not black, not white, red or yellow, but people would like it. Some people would like it. But I learned quickly after I got into the music business that there are so many categories, and you can get lost. You're like a little fish in a big pond, and more so if you're a blues singer, blues musician.
Mm-hmm.
So I was not really wanting to be a crossover, actually, but I wanted all people to hear it and like it. I was hoping, rather, they would like it. And people like Ray Charles, people like Chuck Berry, all these guys to me were very talented, and they was very energetic, Lloyd Price and so on. All of them was very energetic when it come to playing music. They didn't play the slow, droopy drawers music like I did, so I found that maybe that was my reason, because they had things that I didn't have, other way musically or entertaining.
Well, they were playing to teenage audiences, and as you've always pointed out, your audience
was always my age and older.
Yeah, yeah. So could you imagine yourself crossing over to teenagers, playing to teenagers?
No, I could not. And again, I'm trying to say that to hear the people that I mentioned playing, I was never envious of them, because me, I'm the country boy that, you know, that left the country, but they never got the country out of me. So I didn't have that, stage presence that they have. So I was never envious of them being able to get over, but I would hope that people sometime would pay more attention to what I was doing.
In the mid-60s, I guess it was, a lot of the rock guitarists started emulating you. I mean, you became a god to some of them. Mike Bloomfield, Eric Clapton. And that helped introduce your music to college audiences. And then you started playing the college circuit in addition to the places you'd already been playing. What was it like for you to start playing the college circuit? Did you feel like did it feel very different to you? Did you feel like you needed to change anything about your performance style? Was there anything you were doing that didn't seem to translate?
Yes, I was frightened at first. Here I am, a high school dropout, and I'm going to be playing to college audiences. Yes, I felt that I should wear a hard hat and be Fred Astaire or Nat Cole.
You're real suave.
Yeah. But I remember after 3 o'clock blues, I had a manager, and he told me when I was going, it used to be a saying that for a black performer, it was four theaters you had to play and be accepted before you would be accepted as a true entertainer. One of those theaters was the Howard Theater in Washington, the Royal Theater in Baltimore, and the master itself was the Apollo Theater in New York, in Harlem. So my manager told me then, I lived in Memphis, he said, don't go to New York and these other places. Oh, and by the way, the fourth theater was the Regal Theater here in Chicago. However, my manager said, do not go to New York trying to be Nat Cole or anybody else that's trying to be slick, because there are people that sweep in the floors that are much better than you'll ever be. So the best thing for you to do is go there and be B.B. King.
What good advice.
Sing 3 o'clock blues. Mm-hmm. Sing the song that you sing the way you sing them. He said, now, all these other people can do all of those other things, but they can't be you as you can be you. And that I've tried to keep from then until now.
It's been said that you've always felt bad that you dropped out of school, never went to college. Were you self-conscious about that when you were actually playing colleges?
Yes, very much so. I thought that my shortcoming as far as the education was concerned would make me not be, shall we say, good enough to play for a lot of those people.
But it was probably just the opposite, that your audience really wanted to be you.
Well, I don't know about that, but they did show me that they appreciated me being there. Mm-hmm. They still do that. They showed me that they was really with me and supported me in what I was doing. So they gave me confidence.
B.B. King speaking with Terry Gross in 1996. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're listening to Terry's 1996 interview with B.B. King, who turned 80 this month.
One of your recordings that I particularly love happens to be a recording with the Duke Ellington Orchestra. Your recording of Don't Get Around Much Anymore.
Right.
I mean, gee, you don't even play guitar on this. It's so strange. It's such a unusual recording. I had a feel of singing with the Ellington Orchestra.
And, frightening.
And not have a guitar. I mean, I don't think
well,
you're playing.
Well, I was afraid to try to sing, and trying to play guitar would have been just too much. But today, I'm more familiar with a lot of the standard tunes, and I would like to try and play the melodies instead of singing them.
Mm-hmm. started to dance. I heard the crowd at the floor. It's awfully different without you. Don't get around much anymore. I thought I'd visit the club. Got as far as the door. I just couldn't bear it without you. I don't get around much anymore. Darling, I guess my mind is more at ease. But nevertheless, why stir up memories? Been invited on dates. I might have gone, but what for? I just couldn't bear it without you. I don't get around much anymore.
I have met over the years a lot of people who've worked with you or toured with you. And it's just not possible, I think, to get anybody to say a bad word about you. I mean, your reputation is of somebody who treats everybody around him really well, with a lot of respect, always fair, financially and in all other ways as well. And I'm just wondering if that's something that you consciously set out to do, I'm not just trying to be nice here. I mean, I think it's just a kind of a fact that you're known for this. I wonder if you think of yourself just naturally Mr. Nice Guy, or if it's something that you've felt really obliged to do and have been very conscious about doing.
There are some things that I've read that I truly believe in. I believe that one should treat others as they want to be treated. And that's one of the things that I try to live by, if you will, is trying to be fair to people as I want them to be to me.
B.B. King, it's really been such a delight to talk with you. Thank you very, very much for your time.
Thank you. You're very kind to talk with. I enjoy your voice.
Terry Gross speaking with B.B. King in 1996. He turned 80 this month. King is working on a new CD, and he's on tour, performing soon in Newport News, Nashville, and Louisville. Ricky Gervais, co-star and co-creator of the original British version of The Office, returns with a new series this weekend on HBO. TV critic David Bianculli says it's almost unfair to expect any follow-up to The Office to be as brilliantly funny, but in this case, lightning does strike twice.
In The Office, Ricky Gervais played a middle management boss at a company selling paper products from a backwater town in England. His character, David Brent, was astoundingly clueless, mistaking ridicule for affection, making one career-destroying mistake after another, and having absolutely no concept about his own lack of intelligence or social graces. That character, like the show, was a total delight. Not like the Americanized version now showing on NBC, which, by contrast, is tone-deaf. So what do Gervais and his writing and directing partner Stephen Merchant do for an encore? It turns out they do a new comedy series co-produced by the BBC and HBO about one of HBO's favorite subjects, show business. The new series is called Extras, and Gervais stars as Andy Millman, who's been appearing in films for over 5 years, but only barely. He's what they call, in the movie business, a background artist. He stands around in costume or follows behind the stars as they get to act, but never gets to say a word himself. What Andy wants, more than anything, is to score a single line of dialogue. That concept is by no means a recipe for success, especially on HBO, where comedies about showbiz have been hit-and-miss affairs. Larry David's Curb Your Enthusiasm is a hit, so is Entourage. But Lisa Kudrow's comeback was a huge miss, and HBO recently and rightly announced it wasn't coming back for a second season. One element that makes Extras so good is that Stephen Merchant has stepped out from behind the camera to co-star with Gervais. He plays Andy's agent,
A guy so hopelessly inept that he can't even figure out how to answer his own cell phone before it stops ringing. Andy himself is smarter than David Brent from The Office was, and more self-aware, but even less successful. And Andy's agent is a big reason why. Their scenes together, as when Andy gets summoned to his agent's office, are full of awkward silences and Andy's quiet frustration. And they're great.
Nothing's come in, according to that.
Nothing's come in?
No.
Okay, good. Well, that was well worth it. I mean, apart from sitting there and waiting for the phone to ring, what have you done? Have you called it? Have you sent the script out?
What script? Sorry.
Oh, man, the script I gave you 2 months ago.
That sounds good.
The sitcom?
Yeah? Funny?
Yeah, really.
What's it called? Because I can go on to that.
When the whistle blows.
I'll just write down. When the W blows.
Don't put W, you forget what the W stands for. Ride it all out.
No, when the wind blows.
Whistle!
I'll put that in. W equals wind.
Whistle!
Whistle. It's there. It's in.
That's safe then, is it? That's done, I can forget about that. That's on its way, yeah? I got my best man on it.
Yeah, yeah.
Safe hands, safe hands.
Good. Do you want to put another meeting in?
Any point?
May as well, and then when nothing comes in, just phone you up and cancel it.
It's a plan.
Andy also has a best friend at work, Maggie, played by Ashley Jensen. She's a little man-hungry and not quite as quick as Andy, but she's very nice and very amusing in her own right. And then there's the secret weapon of extras, which is the idea that each week's show takes place on a different film set, allowing for guest stars to show up playing often twisted versions of themselves. In the premiere episode, Andy and Maggie get work on a film about World War II. He's dressed as a Nazi, and she's dressed as a Jewish refugee being hidden by nuns. One of those nuns is played by Kate Winslet, who spends her time between scenes chatting with the extras, advising Maggie on how to please a new boyfriend by talking dirty to him on the phone, and explaining why she took the role of the noble nun in the first place. And since this is Kate Winslet, and she's dressed in a nun's habit as she says these things, they're even more unexpected.
How did it go with your dirty phone call?
Oh, haven't done it yet. I'm working up to it.
Well, here is another one that's always good. Just do all the preliminary stuff and then you go, hang on. Why is the slut from next door just coming into my bedroom and is taking a bra off? Then you just pretend you're getting it on with her.
I couldn't do that.
Of course you could. You're an actress.
No, I'm not. I'm just an extra. You're the actress. Brilliant actress, by the way.
Yeah, she's... I'm an actor as well, as. If there's a line going in this film, I'd love to be part of this, because I'd just like to say, I think, you know, you doing this is so commendable, you know, using your profile to keep the message alive about the Holocaust.
My God, I'm not doing it for that. I mean, I don't think we really need another film about the Holocaust, do we? It's like, how many have there been? You know, we get it, it was grim, move on. No, I'm doing it because I've noticed that if you do a film about the Holocaust, guaranteed an Oscar. I've been nominated 4 times, never won. And the whole world is going, why hasn't Winslet won one?
Definitely, yeah.
That's it. That's why I'm doing it.
When Ben Stiller shows up in a subsequent episode, he's even more willing to poke fun at himself. And he's just as uncomfortably hilarious to watch. Extras, right from the start, is another classic comedy from Gervais. For him to do it twice in a row is an absolute rarity. Just as amazing as when Larry David went from co-creating Seinfeld to creating and starring in Curb Your Enthusiasm. Both shows are little TV miracles. And beginning this weekend, they're paired together on HBO.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Coming up, David Edelstein on the new film, A History of Violence. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Director David Cronenberg began his career making films with horrific and invasive images, but in the last few years has moved into the realm of psychological torment. His new movie, A History of Violence, is based on a graphic novel, and film critic David Edelstein says the brutality this time is both physical and emotional.
Violence is the dominant cuisine of world cinema, so any movie that pretends to critique it while serving up a scrumptilicious platter of blood and shattered bone is bound to get some critics shouting, "Masterpiece." That's what you hear about David Cronenberg's A History of Violence. And before I go on, let me say that it is a sensational piece of filmmaking. It's staged and shot and acted and scored like nothing else this year, and it has images that will bury themselves in your brain, rather like an ice pick. I have nothing bad to say about it, except that it shouldn't for a second be taken too seriously. A History of Violence opens with a long, flat take. The camera travels along the exterior of a cheap motel, in front of which two low-life homicidal scumbags make small talk before killing an entire family, including a little girl. This happens, thankfully, off-screen, although nothing that follows does. When the child is shot, there's a cut from the gun blast to another little girl as she wakes from a nightmare, screaming. Her daddy, Tom Stahl, played by Viggo Mortensen, tells her it's okay. There are no monsters, when, of course, we know there are. The setting is a small town in the Midwest, and Tom and his pretty, ex-cheerleader, now lawyer wife, Edie, played by Maria Bello, have a picture-perfect homestead. Tom is picture-perfect, too, with his sky-blue eyes and rangy diffidence. He owns a luncheonette on Main Street and pours coffee while chatting about the weather and would seem an image of Norman Rockwell purity if not for those killers from the opening, passing through town, in need of fast cash. And, well, I don't want to spell out what happens, here or anywhere else, because the film revolves around a big secret. Either Tom is not what he appears to be, or a bad case of mistaken identity is going to force him to become something other than a man of peace. By and by, three more bad men, dark-suited gangsters, saunter into that luncheonette. Their leader, played by Ed Harris, has a mottled, milky, dead eye, which nonetheless fastens on Tom.
Well, welcome to Stahl's. Would you gentlemen like some coffee?
You're the hero.
I don't know, sir.
You're the big hero. Sure took care of those two bad men.
Really don't like talking about it, sir. We're trying to get back to normal here. So can I offer you gentlemen some coffee?
Sure. Give me some coffee. Make it black.
Yes, sir.
Joey.
And your friends?
They don't drink coffee. It doesn't agree with them. Joey.
It's Joey.
You are.
My name's Tom, sir.
Of course it is.
That's a fascinating exchange, pitting Mortensen's tense easiness against Ed Harris's easy tension. Whether he's Joey or not, the heroic act of violence that put Tom in the public eye is going to beget more and more violence, and Cronenberg gives that violence a kinetic charge, as well as the tightness and compression of a frame in a great action comic, or its highbrow cousin, the graphic novel, like the one that this movie is based on. Those sudden bloody discharges are thrilling, even orgasmic. But they also leave you sickened, because Cronenberg cuts briefly in an extra frame, like a comic book's, to men with heads shattered and faces beaten literally to bloody pulps. But here's the thing. Those extra frames don't sicken us morally. Even though A History of Violence is suffused with loss, it's in every bar of Howard Shore's gorgeous, elegiac score. The right people are always on the right end of the right kind of violence. A History of Violence does have dissonances. When a police chief warns the gangsters that the town, quote, protects its own, he's both reassuring and unnerving. It might protect them from people like us, too. Two remarkable sex scenes add wrinkles. The first is a piece of nostalgic play-acting, for which Edie dons her cheerleader outfit and Tom services her lovingly. The second is its opposite, a virtual rape that is explosively unresolved. Maria Bello gives the film an emotional core, and Mortensen's transitions are so subtle that you almost buy his incredible character. Ed Harris and later William Hurt give bravura performances, laugh-out-loud hammy, but with shockingly vicious undercurrents. That's how I think of this movie, too, hammy and shockingly vicious. But what strikes some critics as complexity feels to me like shame, the shame of David Cronenberg, an uncompromising director whose bloodshed has always been morally disturbing, doing simple-minded pulp violence, and, like his protagonist, doing it just a little too triumphantly.
David Edelstein is film critic for Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Endless Pools, the treadmill for swimmers, installed indoors or out. DVD or video available at 877-ENDLESS or endlesspool.com. And from TIAA CREF, serving the financial needs of those in the academic, medical, cultural, and research fields. Online at TIAACREF.org/greater good. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, actors Paul Reiser and Peter Falk. They star as son and father in the new film, The Thing About My Folks, from a screenplay that Reiser wrote. Also graphic designer and commercial director Mike Mills. He's making his feature film debut with the new film, Thumbsucker. Join us for the next Fresh Air.